But anyway, we're looking at Revelation chapter 8 this morning and reading from verse 7. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. And the second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures which are in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels, which are yet to sound." May God bless his word. Now, of course, we're constantly told, and with increasing hysteria, by these nature-worshipping heathens who govern us, that man-made pollution will bring catastrophe upon the planet. I want to say this morning that statement is actually true. Man-made pollution will bring catastrophe upon the planet. And I'm very surprised nobody's walked out yet. Very disappointed. But it is a true statement. However, it's the nature of the pollution that they have wrong. The heathen claim that it is environmental pollution that is our problem. And that's incorrect. It is moral pollution that is our problem. Now, we can think back in history to the last major or global catastrophe which permanently altered the topography and climate of the world, and that took place some 4,300 years ago, Noah's flood. And what was the cause of that great climate change and climate event? It wasn't carbon dioxide. It was the wickedness, evil, and corruption of man, as Genesis chapter 6 records. Those are terms of morality, and that's what brought these calamities upon the earth. It was moral pollution that precipitated God's judgment upon the antediluvian world. And so too, the day of the Lord is his righteous anger against sin poured out upon the world. And as Isaiah 26 verse 21 says, to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. For their iniquity. And so during the tribulation, God will punish the ungodly by disrupting the natural order. And this is what we see in these verses today. Events happening upon the earth, upon the vegetation, upon the seas, upon in the heavenly realm. And it's essential that these descriptions be interpreted literally. Because the preterists, the historicists, if I can pronounce that correctly, and non-literal futurists attempt to interpret these catastrophic events in nature as being symbolic. So the preterists and the historicists, they see these as representing events that happened throughout history, whereas the futurists see them as happening in the future. But they see them as symbolic. And the fact is, there are as many interpretations as interpreters, and there is no way of determining which one is correct. Everyone has, well, I think it represents this or that. Well, which one's right? All of them? None of them. Because you just can't tell. It's all subjective. For instance, and this is by E.W. Bullinger, he gives a review of some of these what people think these represent. He's a literalist, but he says this is what some of these people teach. One interpretation says the fiery mountain means Satan. The sea means the nations. The dying of the fish denotes the persecution and slaughter of Christians. The wreck of the ships denotes the extinction of congregations. He also cites E.B. Eliot, who says the mountain was Genseric with his Vandals, forced by the Huns from their native seat. The sea was there plunging through France and Spain into Africa, selling themselves in conquered territory. The destruction of fish, etc., was their depredations on the neighbouring islands and shores of the Mediterranean. Another system, he says, tells us the sea is the church with its baptismal waters. The mountain is some great heresy. The blood is a corruption by deadly error. The destruction of fish is the destruction of souls. The wreck of ships is the overturning of churches. And you can just go on and on and on. In terms of futurists, J.N. Darby says, that which is elevated, eminent, lofty is intended by the trees. And the young, feeble and aged are meant by the green grass. That's what he says they might represent. H.A. Ironside takes the same view and says that the star from heaven is the Pope. Okay, and so, you know, it's just, like I say, it could mean anything. And just depends on what the person feels like they want to interpret it as. To regard these events described here as being anything but literal is to subject the Bible to endless conjecture, a quagmire of speculation, never coming to a certain understanding of what is meant. And so we just need to take it literally. Why wouldn't you? And another factor is that many of these judgments bear parallels with the plagues on Egypt. Now, do we understand those plagues, those 10 plagues on the Egyptians, as being literal? Did the water literally turn to blood then? And even these people who interpret Revelation symbolically or metaphorically, they'd say, yes, it was literal. Well, why wouldn't you see the water turning to blood in Revelation chapter 8 as literal too? What's the difference? One's in the past, one's in the future. Darkening the sun, etc. That actually happened in the plagues, and so that was we could see that in Egypt on a local scale. Well, here in Revelation, it's going to happen on a global scale. Now, the first six trumpet judgments occur very close to the midpoint of the 7-year tribulation period, as far as we can reckon. And while the seventh trumpet and the attendant seven vials take place in the final half. So we're getting close to the midpoint of the tribulation. When you come to chapter 9, there is a time span given. These creatures out of the bottomless pit, they torment man for 5 months. And so, you know, we might be about 3 years into it, to allow for that 5 months before the 3.5-year period is reached, but it seems to be around that midpoint. And so the proportion of the earth affected by these judgments increase as the tribulation progresses. Remember back in chapter 6, there's one fourth part of the earth was affected in chapter 6 and verse 8. Now we have one third being affected under the trumpets, and then the whole earth will be affected under the vials. It just becomes more and more intense. And so, you know, you read these things and you think, boy, this is horrible. How could it get any worse? No, it does get much worse as you go through towards the end of those 7 years. and so you see those things. But what we're looking at today is the first four trumpets, which affect nature. The land, the water, the heavenly bodies, and then the fifth and sixth trumpets in chapter 9 summon forth demonic forces against men. So this is against nature, and in chapter 9 it actually directly upon men. The first thing we see is a burning destruction in the herbal realm. All right, and so this is the first trumpet, which is recorded there in the verse 7, and it affects the trees and the grass and so on. And so what you have here is hail, fire and blood cast upon the earth. Lines up with the seventh plague on Egypt, which was hail and fire. It talks about God sent thunder and hail and fire ran upon the ground. And all these things took place. And now, as to how can we explain these things in a in the natural systems. Well, some think it could be a result of volcanic activity with rocks and lava hailing down from eruptions and just spewing forth all over the planet and, you know, just raining lava and fire and rocks and so on there. But what about the blood? Well, the blood may refer to the rain itself that's been transformed to blood, or to the bloodshed of men and beasts that are affected by the hail. And so God's hailing down these things. People are just being split open and their heads being, you know, bursting open. There's going to be bloodshed on a massive scale. But it could be God just actually makes it rain and hail blood. The hail mixed with blood. It's going to be a fearful time. But it, as a result of this hail and fire and so on, it says that these were cast on the earth. Third part of the trees was burnt up. And so the loss of one third of the earth's trees will drastically affect mankind. You take out a third of the trees. I mean, you think of the consequences. The fruit trees, a third of them gone. The production of food, it's greatly reduced. What else do trees... Well, trees are like the lungs of the planet, aren't they? Reduced oxygen levels in the atmosphere. They're not doing their job to convert to the carbon dioxide to oxygen. And then the smoke from the fires that are burning up these trees and grass will cover the world and choke men and beasts. And so you think of the whole change of the atmosphere and the famines and all the rest, it's going to be just awful. It's going to be tribulation, literally, on these people. But not only the trees, third part of the trees burnt up. It says at the end of verse 7, and all green grass was burnt up. It doesn't just say a third of the grass, all the grass. And so we saw previously under the second seal there was drought and famine. That was in chapter 6 and verse 6. You can imagine there was a lot of dead vegetation, dead grass, just ready to burn. And this sets it off, fire coming down, and all these wildfires just all over the world. And it'll be ripe for wildfires. But you think of grass, and what are grasses? Well, grasses covers a lot of crops, a lot of food crops, grains, they're grasses, wheat, corn, rice, all burnt up, all gone. Fodder for cattle, burnt up. And there'll be a global famine. It's just great reduction of food supply. Joel speaks about this in the first chapter, in verses 15 to 20. He says, the fire hath devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and the flame hath burned all the trees of the field. The beasts of the field cry also unto thee, for the rivers of water are dried up, and the fire hath devoured the pastures of the wilderness. Just burning all over the planet. And just something as we ponder these things of what God is doing, and we should remember that God has a right to devastate his creation because he is the creator and all the creation belongs to him. It belongs to him. He has a right to do whatever he pleases with it, include devastate it. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Now, the original creation was perfect and untainted, without corruption, without suffering. Everything was very good at the end of that creation week. Very good. You know, none of these things that we see today, all these the hardships and misery going on in the creation. But what happened? Man's sin brought death and the curse, not only upon humanity, but upon the whole earth, which is now subject to corruption and suffering. It wasn't just man that was affected, the whole creation was affected. You read that in Genesis 3. And Paul speaks about that in Romans chapter 8. He says, for the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. That's in the future, being freed from the curse. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. The whole creation, the animal kingdom, you know, the botanical kingdom, it's just groaning under sin and the curse. And while even now the creation groans and travails in pain as a result of sin, this travail will be greatly increased during the tribulation. And so this is God in just bringing this travail upon the whole creation. Now, we could also consider that the environmentalist nature worshipping that is present in our day and prevalent in our day will be answered by God in sending destruction from heaven upon the objects of their idolatry. What are these people doing? These people who are just going on about the world, climate change, these tree huggers, they're worshipping nature. That's their God. And that's why they want to devote their whole lives to the preservation of trees and the Great Barrier Reef and all. It's because they worship it. In much the same way that the plagues of Egypt were sent upon and a judgment of God upon the gods of the Egyptians, they worship these natural systems. Likewise, God is going to do the same thing in the tribulation. And he's going to devastate what these people are worshipping today and what they'll be worshipping in the future. You imagine if our governmental leaders would read this and would believe what it says is about to come on the planet, all this devastation, all this burning and what's going to happen to the seas and the fish dying and everything else. You think how that might affect the decisions that they make? Do you think they'd be throwing $1 billion or $500 million to save the Great Barrier Reef? Yeah, they might think, well, you know what? It's going to be pretty much destroyed in a short time. Let's spend that money on something useful. Do you think they'd be halting the building of a mine there in central Queensland because they want to save a little black-throated finch? I mean, it's because they worship these animals. But if only our leaders would just believe what this says and not just go out and wantonly destroy nature, we should look after it. But God gave us these things to use. And ultimately, there's going to be mass destruction on these natural systems. And may God give us leaders who would believe the Bible. So anyway, we see first of all burning destruction in the herbal realm, and then in verses 8 to 11, blood and defilement in the hydrological realm. So we come to the second and third trumpets. They affect the waters of planet Earth. In verses 8 and 9, one third of the sea becomes blood. And so what happens is there's something, as it were, a great mountain burning with fire cast into the sea, and it converts the third part of the sea to blood. Well, some think it could be a meteorite. It's burning. It's coming out of heaven. It's like a mountain, but it's not saying it is a mountain. It's like it. But at any rate, it hits the oceans of the earth, and its impact on the world's oceans will bring death and devastation. It'll just turn everything upside down. And this echoes the first plague on Egypt. Remember the water to blood. And this will happen again in the future. He turns the water to blood. Now, this should be understood as literal blood, not a blood-like substance. And, people can talk about, blood tides, and there's things happening even now where you have these red, the sea turns red for different things that go on in it. But if it says blood, we should just understand it to be blood, I think. And it's interesting, the chemical composition of seawater and blood are very similar. In fact, in emergency situations, people have used seawater for blood transfusion. And so there's a lot of similarities there. But the scientists tell us that 72% of the Earth's surface is covered in water, and one third of that will become blood. That's massive. That's huge scale of effect on the oceans. A third part of the sea creatures will die. Of course, this will create further food shortages. Many peoples rely on seafood for sustenance, and this will affect their food supply. But it also says there in the verse 9, a third part of the ships were destroyed. And so if this thing hits the water, you can imagine the tsunamis that are created by these waves and this thing hitting the water, and capsizing ships, Yes, you realise how important ships are for the world today. Our supplies, international supplies of whatever, they come on these massive cargo ships. That'll be greatly affected. Oil tankers and different things. Fuel and transportation. People even moving from one place to another, that's going to be affected. Of course, the skies are going to be affected and all the smoke. They're probably not going to be able to fly very much. Sea transport, fuel supplies. It's going to be an upheaval of civilization. Now, you think of how God gave us the seas. What a blessing it was that God gave us a planet with seas. And the seas, under God's mercy, are a source of life, of blessing, providing food, oxygen and rain. You think of the oxygen that's created from it's a plankton or whatever it is, and oxygen from the seas, and of course the hydrological cycle, bringing rain to the land, all the food and everything else. That's God in his mercy and the blessing that the seas are to man. But under his justice, they become the source of misery and death to a rebellious and ungrateful mankind. God's given us all these things. Is man grateful for all these things? No. In fact, man blasphemes the God who's given us all things to enjoy. So he turns his mercy to justice and he afflicts the oceans. And then in verses 10 and 11, one third of the rivers become polluted. And again, there's something coming from heaven. This time it's called, there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And so this could be another meteorite. It's that same word as is used in chapter 6 and verse 13, where it talks about the stars of heaven fell to the earth, aster, where we get the word asteroid. And so it doesn't necessarily mean a burning star like our sun. It could be just some celestial body falling from the sky. And so this meteorite perhaps, but it affects the freshwater bodies on earth and the rivers. And possibly this asteroid, it's got contaminants, it's got toxic gases and things. Maybe as it comes into the Earth's atmosphere, it starts to split up and it breaks up into small parts and go to different parts of the planet. And when it hits the water, it affects the water and makes it poisonous and toxic. We don't really know, but at any rate, it says that this star affects the waters. Incidentally, Albert Barnes, he sees this star as Attila the Hun. No, it's something falling from heaven, literal heaven, a literal heavenly body falling on the literal rivers and fresh waters. Now, but it's got a name, this star. It's in verse 11. It's called Wormwood. And that Wormwood is a translation of the Greek absinthos, where we get absinthe, the plant. And this plant is a stupefying and sometimes toxic plant product, wormwood. And it's bitter tasting. You find bitterness associated with this wormwood as it appears throughout the scripture. and it appears a number of times. Lamentations 3:19, remembering mine affliction and my misery, the wormwood and the gall. So it's sometimes used even figuratively to represent bitterness and anguish and so on. But wormwood is also connected to idolatry in Deuteronomy 29 verse 18. It says there, lest there should be among you a man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. And he says wormwood is like idolatry, worshipping false gods. It's a bitter thing. And God, in fact, judged the idolaters of Israel by giving them wormwood, as it were, to drink. You find that in Jeremiah 8, verse 14, in chapter 9, verse 14 to 16. For instance, it says there, behold, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood, and give them water of gall to drink, because they've been going after idols. And so this is wormwood is like a judgment making them drink this toxic and or poisonous substance. And you find these things, and God will likewise do, as he did to Israel, to the idolaters of the earth during the tribulation. He'll make them drink wormwood, and they'll be affected by it. Now, you think how important, how essential water is to human life. One of the most basic requirements for life, and you can't survive for more than a few days without water. But in the tribulation, water will be very, very scarce. And people, for a lot of people, the only water they'll have access to is polluted water. And they'll drink it, they'll get sick, and many people will die. It says that in verse 11. Many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. Toxic water. You know, we hear it's something that's really foreign to us. You know, we hear about in Africa these waterborne diseases. People that have this water, it's got all these things in it, you know, these bacteria. They're going to cause them great sickness. They drink it and they have all these horrible sicknesses, parasites. And, you know, they can become very sick and they die from them. And it's a third world thing. Well, I tell you what, in the tribulation, the whole world will become the third world. Every country will be third world. Even Australia, United States, Europe, you know, they'll have water that is polluted. It'll make them sick. It'll make them die. And it's going to be, you know, they'll try filtering it. They'll try boiling it. But no, it's bitter. And it's going to cause them to die. Many men will die. You see God afflicting the waters of the planet. And then thirdly, in verses 12 to 13, the baneful darkening in the heavenly realm. And so here we come to the fourth angel and the fourth trumpet. The sun and the moon and the stars are darkened. And this is a characteristic of the day of the Lord. It's a day of darkness, Isaiah 13 and verse 10. The stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. Joel 2 verse 2, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness, etc. Amos 5:18, woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord. To what end is it for you? The day of the Lord is darkness and not light. And in the Lord Jesus, in Mark 13, 24, but in those days after that tribulation, the sun shall be darkened and the moon shall not give her light. And this harkens back to the ninth plague upon the Egyptians. It was darkness. It was complete darkness, but it was darkness all the same. Now, what is this darkening of the heavens? Well, it's suggested by some to be from the thick clouds in the atmosphere obscuring the sun's light. You know, the fires and all this volcanic activity. You know, there's going to be great atmospheric pollution, and that could be a cause of it. Yet it may be that God actually alters the sun itself to diminish its energy output. Of course God can do that. I'll quote here Henry Morris. He says, a naturalistic scientist might object that such a thing is impossible. This, however, would be to say more than he knows. The nature of both the internal reactions in the sun and the external reactions on the sun's surface are still unknown. Solar physicists, until recently, were confident that the sun's output of radiant energy resulted mainly from thermonuclear fusion processes in the sun's interior. Now, however, the absence of the flux of solar neutrinos from the sun, which should be generated by such reactions, is causing a complete rethinking of the whole problem. Recent evidence that the sun is measurably shrinking in size apparently meant that much of the sun's energy output results from gravitational collapse. Presumably, this would be true of other stars as well. Thus, if the gravitational shrinking of the sun could be slowed down for a time, possibly its light output would also be slowed down. You know, and so there could be some, but at any rate, it's going to get dark and it's going to only produce a third of its light. And it even says there that the day shone not for a third part of it. And so it even seems like in the daytime, the sun won't even shine at all. for a third part of the day, and then there'll be light for the other two-thirds of it. But it's going to have a great effect. And the reduced heat from the sun will bring unprecedented effects upon the Earth's climate, weather, and biological cycles. You know, the whole climate, the weather systems, the highs and the lows, and that's all from the heat of the sun. And it's all generated by that. It's going to be turned upside down. And when the temperature gets turned down, the plant life, the animal life, you think of just what sort of weather events will be precipitated from the sun being darkened. And I believe in these days mankind will be brought back to a very primitive state. Industry, factories, they'll be shut down. Electricity will most likely be gone. I mean, the whole place is probably going to be running on solar panels, and the sun's gone, so there's no power. Everything will be, the infrastructure will be just destroyed and everything. And people just go back to just hand to mouth, just trying to, they'll be eating, you know, grass, and they'll be just trying to get some food. There won't be firearms, they won't be producing weapons and ammunition. You know, this is why it talks about they're going to be fighting with swords, riding horses and all. It's going to go back to the old days before technology and all these things. And what is God doing? Well, God will strike at the proud accomplishments of man as he did with Nebuchadnezzar. Remember Nebuchadnezzar's boasting and how he built all his kingdom and everything. And God said, well, I'll show you who's boss. And he made him like a beast for 7 years and just eating the grass and everything else. That's what God is going to do to mankind in these days and shatter his pride and his accomplishments. And yet for all this, they will not repent. And you see that at the end of chapter 9, and we'll look at that when we get to it. All these plagues and all this suffering, yet neither repented they of their murders and all the rest of it. They just refused to repent. And they continued to blaspheme the Lord. What an awful thing. And then in verse 13, there's another angel appears. Behold, another angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe. He pronounces this threefold woe. You'll find if you ever consult other Bible versions, you'll find they will read eagle. And so it's not an angel, it's an eagle flying, it's an eagle saying woe, woe, etc. And that's because these modern versions are based on the critical Greek text, the corrupt text, whereas the received text, the inspired one, reads angel. And so we'll stick with angel. Certainly makes a lot more sense than an eagle speaking these things. It's the role of an angel to pronounce these woes. But what is woe? Woe indicates grief and anguish, and it's intensified by this threefold repetition, the intense woe that is coming. And so his pronouncement assures the inhabitants of the earth that the worst is yet to come. He says that these trumpets of the three angels, which are yet to sound, it's only going to get worse. More people are going to die in what comes with the following trumpets than what have died already. And what are those trumpets? Well, the fifth and the sixth trumpets unleash demonic forces to torment man, while the seventh trumpet, which is the third woe, brings the seven vial or bowl judgments. And they are definitely three woes. Okay, it only gets worse. But just as we finish up with some closing thoughts, these judgments are a foretaste of hell. You can see elements of hell in these judgments. We see hell's desolation. There will not be one green tree or one blade of grass in hell, only burning desolation. No greenness, no pastures, just desolation and fire. We also see hell's dehydration. There'll be no water in hell. Not even a drop to cool the tongue of the damned. Not one drop of water. The water is going to be gone. And what if the darkness? Well, hell is darkness. It's a place of outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. There's no light in hell, only darkness. And we see these echoes of hell in these judgments here in chapter 8. And though the tribulation will not be hell on earth, it'll be a foretaste of it. But on the other hand, the believer in Jesus shall not come into condemnation and need not fear these judgments. Jesus said that in John 5:24. He that heareth my word and believeth on him that sent me hath everlasting life and shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life. No condemnation for the believer. And so, whereas the green grass and pastures are taken away from the unbeliever, well, for the believer, there's eternally green pastures. For the believer, Psalm 23, verse 2, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures. As for trees, well, there's access to the tree of life. The tree of life is granted to the believer. To the unbeliever, no grass, no trees. And what are the waters that will be judged? Well, the child of God has free and eternal access to the water of life through Jesus Christ. Remember the conversation between the Lord Jesus and the woman of Samaria. He spake of giving her living water. He said, whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. And of course, in that final invitation in Revelation 22, and the Spirit and the Bride say, come, and let him that heareth say, come, and let him that is athirst come, and whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely. That water of life to the believer. But what about darkness? Well, for the believer, there's no darkness ahead of him. The believer no longer walks in darkness, but has the light of life and will dwell in the eternal light of the Lamb, who is the light of the world. He is the light of the world. And whosoever believes on him should not abide in darkness. And that New Jerusalem, in Revelation 21, verse 23, it says, and the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. For the unbeliever, darkness, but for the believer is eternal light. You know, the Christian can say, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come. And, you know, it doesn't matter how prosperous a life that the Christian has enjoyed, how much of the good things of this world he's enjoyed, it's still true that the best is yet to come. Not just a magnitude better, but infinitely better. Not even a billion times better, but infinitely better. The best is yet to come. But on the other hand, just like the angel said, there's worse to come. For the believer, the worst is yet to come. For the unbeliever, the worst is yet to come. And it does not matter how miserable a life the unbeliever has endured, how much torture and suffering and hardship that the unbeliever has endured, what is yet to come is worse. Again, not a magnitude worse, not a million or billion times worse, but infinitely worse. Both in its nature and its duration. The worst is yet to come. We need to each ask ourselves, which is for us? Is the best yet to come, or is the worst yet to come? Which is yours, eternal joy or eternal woe?